Hi, my name is Professor Caroline Mansfield, and I'd be delighted if you could join me on Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024 at 7 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time as I delve into the big hot topic of dysbiosis in dogs and cats. We're going to discuss what dysbiosis is and how we can potentially diagnose it, focusing on whether microbiome sequencing is clinically relevant. Hopefully by the end of the session, you'll be able to choose a prebiotic, probiotic, or postbiotic for your patients with a much more personalised approach. For more information and to register, please follow the link in the show notes. It'd be fantastic to see you there.
Welcome to the Pure Animal Podcast, where we enlighten veterinary workers, animal lovers, and pet parents about integrative approaches to veterinary medicine and pet health. Each month, we interview experts in their fields as they share cutting-edge science, clinical wisdom, and inspiration. The Pure Animal Podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia. We pay our respects to elders past and present. I'm Dr. Sarah Howard, and returning to the podcast today is Professor Wendy Boltzer. Today we're going to be discussing everything about geriatric care with a special focus on managing advanced osteoarthritis. Welcome back, Wendy. Thank you so much for joining us today. And we are going to be talking about a very special topic, which is how do we care for our geriatric patients or for those pet parents listening, how do you care for your geriatric pets? So starting out, what age does a pet become a geriatric? Is there sort of a different classification depending on their size or their breed? Can you just give us a bit of a definition of what geriatric is before we get going?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Yeah, it's very different based on if it's a dog or a cat, if it's a small breed dog or a large breed dog, and even within those defined areas, we have different rates of development of geriatric disease. And so the most basic way we can look at it and the way it can translate to owners is that, you know, in smaller dogs, we consider them to reach a senior age. So we're from middle age to senior starting at 7 years of age. And that's when I usually like to get them in and have their like midlife health physical and assessment. And then we go on to the senior care of them. And then when they reach, depending on their size, a few years later, then we enter them into the geriatric phase. And so for dogs weighing less than 9 kilos, it would be, you know, 8 to 10 years of age, they're senior, and 11 and onwards, they're geriatric. But
right,
we get all the way up to a 55-kilogram dog, you know, they reach their senior age at 4 or 5.
Oh, wow. So young.
Yeah. Everybody thinks, oh, they're still young, and it's no, how senior. And at the age of 6 onwards, they're considered geriatric. So, you know, your average Labrador would be considered senior at age 7 and geriatric at age 8 onwards. Mm-hmm. And so prolonging their life is, one, we want them to live longer, but we also want them to have a lot better quality of life. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about them slowing down as they get older and things like that. They don't know that they're older, right? They don't have the same sense of time. They think, you know, just everything, and they don't get that they're older. They just know that they're stiffer or they're painful or, you know, things like that. And so if we can promote that kind of livelihood and that comfort, then we know we're doing well with their care, regardless of how long they eventually live. They've lived their life thinking that they're 2 forever.
Oh gosh, wouldn't it be so nice to be living in the present like a dog or a cat and not be worried about the passage of time? Exactly. You just would never have anxiety about the future.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's important. And I know that later on we're going to be touching on the sort of sensitive topic of considering when an appropriate end of life is for some of these patients. And I think that's something that we haven't necessarily discussed at length on the podcast yet, but it's a particularly important and relevant topic to all our practitioners and all our pet parents listening. Something that we're facing as vets almost on a daily basis. But before we get there, I just want to sort of try and understand from your approach. So you mentioned getting patients in when they're sort of considered in their midlife. So obviously that's going to be a different age depending on the size of the animal, the breed of the animal. So you mentioned that you do a sort of midlife health care assessment. What does that involve, and how are you changing a health care plan for these patients after they reach that midlife? Are you sort of requiring people to come back in more frequently? Are you doing more frequent bloods and imaging? Can you take us through your sort of individual approach as a practitioner?
Yeah, absolutely. At around 7 for dogs and, about 7 to 9 for cats, I do like them to come in. I do a full assessment. So, and that means there's a general exam, but I also do an orthopedic and neurologic exam and an ocular exam as well. And I also look at doing a minimum database on them, and that would include urinalysis and some blood work. And depending on their breed, it differs with what I'm expecting to find. If I have a brachycephalic breed like a Frenchie or a pug, then I'm going to be looking for signs of, airway disease or liver disease, things that are more, or even spinal pain and arthritis in their spine. Mm-hmm. And if I'm looking at a Labrador Retriever, I'm going to be looking for, hypothyroidism and elbow arthritis and hip arthritis, things like that. And so it is kind of breed dependent in cats. That's their whole nother ball of wax, really. But in cats, radiographic signs of OA are often present in up to 72% of cats who are 6 years old or older. And then half of them have it, OA signs in multiple joints, yet we're not recognizing when they have the arthritic signs. So there are risk factors for the development of OA. And obviously some breeds are at increased risk, and those would include the Golden Retriever and the Labrador Retriever and the Rottweiler and the German Shepherd. But we would say the odds ratio of developing, severe osteoarthritis is more likely in the Rottweiler, the Dogo de Bordeaux, and the Old English Sheepdog. But further than that, dogs that are desexed have an increased risk of osteoarthritis when they're older. And if they're larger breed, of course, as they get older, their risk of OA increases. And interestingly enough, if they're insured, they also have an increasing risk. And we don't know if that's because, they have owners that take care of them and exercise them a lot. They're overnutritioned. There's a lot of different factors to that, but genetics. And then also, I have a yellow Labrador myself, and she, of course, is 4 times more likely to rupture her cruciate ligament than a chocolate or a black lab.
And really, so, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so her insurer is like, no, we're only going to pay for $2,000 for her knee surgeries. Whereas everything else is like $20,000, and so they're anticipating that she's going to rupture her cruciate. Now she hasn't yet. And so we can kind of use her name is Sky, as kind of, as a poster child for that. So what do I do for her, as a middle-aged dog that's at risk for developing, OA and, who will develop these older age problems. And we can talk about other things that happen as they age as well. So we'll be looking for, at that visit, signs of muscle loss. So they increase our rate of muscle turnover and protein turnover in our body as we age. So we actually need more protein as we get older and less carbohydrate. Mm-hmm. And so we need to change their diet for that. And then we want to look at, you know, if do they have a genetic risk for arthritis? We want to change their diet for that. Do we see signs of like hypothyroidism or endocrine disease, or do we see signs of eye disease or ear disease, things like that? We also have to pay attention to that. And then how much do they weigh? Increasing body weight and overweight risk of disease. So we that as well. And, you know, I think that's something that is important to get started on at that visit. So it's an important visit that I try and schedule more time for, because we always talk about, wow, we never have enough time. In 15 minutes, yeah, that's okay for, you know, a 2-year-old, but it's not okay for a 7-year-old. A 7-year-old, the owner should be expecting to have a more in-depth visit and kind of this massive health check. And and that, I think, puts them on the right track. Now, if everything looks good and we develop a plan, then I don't ask to see them but once a year. However, if they have an OA, if they have signs of decline, then, and I'm changing a lot in the way they're managed at home, then I'm going to ask to see them more often, or we'll have them start different kinds of therapies, even physiotherapy, things like that.
Yeah, and we'll get into all of that. I'd love to go into sort of what an ideal management plan looks like. I'm just thinking for our general practitioner vets that might not have the access or might not have, you know, clients that potentially want to come in and do a full midlife health check and spend the money on the investigations. If you're trying to educate a pet parent on what to look for at home to decide on sort of to start on an osteoarthritis plan, what are the major symptoms, the really early symptoms that you would be advising them to look out for? And I guess, you know, going back to your comment on cats and how they're very good at hiding their symptoms, and most of them have radiographic evidence of OA in multiple joints, and how are they sort of getting by in life with all that pain? What are some of the really subtle things that we should look out for as, you know, as pet parents at home?
Yeah. I mean, dogs are relatively straightforward. So they get stiff when they get up. So when they're resting, they get stiffness, they're slower to rise, they have either a weight gain or a weight loss that you notice. And you know, they have exercise intolerance, they're unlikely to jump up onto the bed or into vehicles. And so it becomes pretty obvious when something is wrong, their appetite changes and things like that. Now cats, they are both predators and prey animals. So for them to show lameness is to become a target to a predator. So they don't show lameness. And in fact, it's even difficult to feel osteoarthritis and crepitus, so crunching in their joints, unlike dogs, where it's pretty easy to feel with fat and cats. And so instead we see not lameness, but signs that they're not grooming appropriately. They're not grooming their back, or they're grooming an area too much, or they don't want you to pet them in a certain area. So they have changes in their sensation, and they can also have changes in jumping, how often they want to interact with you and the family. And then that can go all the way to, you know, urinating outside the litter box. And,
yeah, I was going to mention that.
Yeah. And so all of that starts to become, and that's not age-related change. They don't know they're getting older. It's because it's too hard to get over to the litter box, or it's too slippery to get over to the food bowl. Or, you know, the dog doesn't want to bend down and drink, so he's constantly dehydrated because it's
how sad.
Water. Yeah. But we don't notice unless we check, right? So I have a handout that I give clients when I see them and even email them just to say, look, this is where you're at. This is not a death sentence or anything like that. It's all about, you know, aging beautifully and doing all the things that you can do to your best ability to have, you know, age is not a disease, and it's not. Mm-hmm. It's just that you're more predisposed to certain diseases as you age, but you can prevent them as well. So in the, you know, in cats, you know, 82% by the time they reach 14 have moderate to severe arthritis.
Wow. And so,
And most of those cats are not receiving any treatment, none. And yet they're sleeping on the bed all day and they don't play anymore. So we need to recognize that. And, you know, in dogs, it's very common as well for them to, you know, by the time they're six, at least half, if not more, have arthritis. So, and that's even in little dogs, it just varies as to where it is. And I think that is important to say, and then know your breed, you know, and know, okay, I have a pug, they're more likely to get disc herniation and back pain. So I'm going to monitor that, and I'm going to monitor their body weight and make sure they don't get too overweight and that they don't overheat and things like that. But I think that's important. It. Yeah. And educating them about that. We always talk about changing their diet when they reach middle age. So, you know, cats don't like to be on the same diet. They like variety. So it's pretty easy to offer them variety, but you, in dogs and cats, you want to switch them more to a fish-based diet, which is high in omega-3 fatty acids, because that is way less inflammation. And if you have arthritis, you want to do, you want to suppress inflammation. But also, you know, in older animals and in humans, we have a disease called inflammaging. And I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Yeah, inflammaging. Yeah, I have heard of it.
Oh, inflammaging, some people say. Yeah, and so it's not common, and it doesn't occur in dogs, but it does occur in cats. And we need to recognize the fact that they're predisposed to this. So what we need to do is have a diet where it's really low. You're low in inflammation. You know, like Alaskan people who eat nothing but fish, they don't have osteoarthritis. They don't have, you know, plaques in their heart or arterial disease or things like that, because they just don't have that inflammation. But they only omega-3, so that's why.
Yeah, and so did you actually say just earlier that dogs don't have that inflammation? It's only cats?
So it's very different between the species about who gets, you know, inflammation and who doesn't. And so it is species specific about what happens. And, you know, we always thought, oh, dogs get obese when they get fat, but when they get OA, but are they getting fat because they have, are they getting OA because they're fat? Well, in humans, your fat releases hormones that actually stimulate osteoarthritis in your joints. But that's not true for dogs. Yeah.
Interesting. But it is true for cats in that if they are overweight, then their adipose tissue produces sort of inflammatory factors that affect the joints directly.
Well, cats is still controversial whether they do that. But as they age, they are more prone to inflammation, which does play a role in their very high risk of osteoarthritis as they get older.
Interesting.
Yeah. So when we talk about, you know, geriatric care, there are some things that we need to specifically look at with species. But even so, because of the high prevalence of some of these diseases, like, you know, the muscle wasting, which is called sarcopenia, that is super common in all species. Right? We want to address OA because it's very common in all of these species. And OA has periods of inflammation. So we want to suppress that if we can. So I think when we start talking about generalities.
Yeah, and I guess that leads really nicely into what a typical management plan would look like. And I know in our podcast that we published a few months ago, we spoke about all about prevention and about sort of young patients and how we set them up for the greatest success in their lifespan. But if we consider now that we have a patient that has osteoarthritis, either, you know, officially diagnosed with radiographs or on clinical examination or history or all of the above, what is a management plan from sort of thereafter look like, and how does it differ between dogs and cats?
Yeah, so for management, the management is, it's a lot of it's the same. We want to keep them active, and so we want to change their environment to keep them active. So we start having areas where they're more easily accessible. So non-slip floors, you have either rubber mats or carpet in their most active areas. You have easy access to food and water. So environment's the first basic step. And if we do nothing else, we change their environment. So we elevate their food bowls and their water. We have water that's easily accessible in multiple places, both inside and outside. And sure that they have easy access to go outside. So, or to go to the litter box, because we talk about, you know, stone development, urinary tract disease, things like that.
And obviously, you know, for those pets that like to jump up on beds and couches and things, putting little ramps or steps and things. And actually, funnily enough, I saw for anyone listening that you can get little carpeted step stools from Aldi for your pets this week, which is probably not going to be relevant to anyone once they listen to the podcast, but they're very easily accessible, it seems, and not expensive. So no excuse really to set up your house to be friendly to a pet with osteoarthritis.
Absolutely. And yeah, so, and then a ramp outside, or adding sticker decals that are like sandpaper stair treads that you can get at.
Oh, yeah. Good idea. Yeah.
Short, you can put those out for your steps, or put, you know, a ramp in, things like that. But make it easy for them to be active. And also make sure that you're providing them with an environment that's still stimulating. So for my cats, I always recommend that they have a cat treat or some sort of climbing apparatus, because they want to be high. That is one, not only a sense of safety, but also a sense of adventure for them. But, you know, some cat trees are really difficult to climb. They make them difficult. You know, easier stairs for them to get to that perch spot, and their ability to perch and things like that really keeps them active and improves their quality of life. So, you know, just switching. I did have one cat that was 17 when she started coming to me, and she was urinating on the bed, just laid on the bed all day, wasn't using the cat tree, you know, just really pretty significant OA in her elbows. And we started treating her. But one of the things we did was, you know, we got her a cat tree that was easily accessible, and we put carpet in the house. And she, you know, with treatment, we did physiotherapy and things like that. And she started running around like a maniac. And that owner came once a week till the cat was 23.
23. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, every single week, because she was like, my cat benefits so much, you know, this is just part of her care. And she was really happy. She passed away from cancer, but, you know, she had a whole 5 more years. She was going to put her down, but, you know, we were like, look, this is all manageable, but we do need to look at the whole picture for her.
Yeah. I love that, you know, taking that sort of multimodal, holistic approach. And just you just mentioned physio as one of the sort of pillars in your management plan. And I'm assuming you also would utilize things like hydrotherapy where possible, and different, you know, modalities of movement to encourage muscle, you know, muscle growth and strength and sort of joint, you know, health and function. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do want to encourage play, but we also want to encourage some work activity. But everything it's all about moderation. So we want moderate exercise, moderate play. So in animals that have significant mobility issues, we do have them come into the clinic, and you know, our goals of treatment are to reduce any kind of pain so that they feel good. We want to build muscle so that they can be active. And then we want to stimulate their zest for life. So, you know, I had one guy, he had this 17-year-old rat terrier, and she actually, was she 17? No, 18. And he's like, she just sits around at home, does nothing. And then we started treating for her arthritis, and he's like, she follows me around everywhere now. I can't even go to the bathroom without her, because she really wanted to hang out with him and be with him, and she felt comfortable enough to do that. And that's what we want. We want them engaging again. So
rewarding.
At home exercises we do every day. We talk about changing their bedding. So as we get older, our circulation isn't so great. So when we sleep, we need softer bedding with more support. So we talk about memory foam, but also eggshell foam, things like that, and providing that in several areas throughout the house so that they can choose where to go. And then there are even, you know, types of jackets and vests when they go out in very cold areas where they have ceramic in the fabric, so it helps warm the tissue so that they don't have stiffness. So it's really, really good for those
amazing
guys. Just warming up so they don't have that stiffness really makes a difference for them and their comfort and their activity. And then, you know, if I have an animal that has significant sarcopenia, we do a whole diet evaluation, because their diet, once you're senior, should be 30% protein. And again, that's because of the rapid turnover that you have in your body. You just need more. And if we want to build muscle, we definitely need 30% protein. And the more muscle you have, the healthier you are, you know, cardiovascularly and mobility-wise, but also brain-wise too. So that kind of change in diet is important. We talk about cognitive decline as well. And cognitive, that decline is partly from your brain. Once you reach middle age, and this is kind of scary, but it's true, we talk about having senior moments, right? Well, as you age, your brain and spinal cord lose the ability to use glucose for energy. And they actually rely on fatty acids for nutrition. And if you're not taking in enough fatty acids and you don't have enough for that, then your brain actually starves. And from the time you're 16 till you're 80 as a human, your brain can atrophy to a third of its original 16-year-old size. That's and so incredible. We talked about supplementing them with like medium chain triglycerides, and that goes straight to your brain, and it makes a difference. And you know, you can get diets that are brain diets, things like that. Yeah. Obviously, you forgot how to walk through a doorway, learn how to walk through a doorway again and recognize our owners. So again, changing how we feed, a diet, it actually plays a huge role in that. But and then environment. And then when they have specific problems and we've identified them, then we get on board with treatment early. And a lot of it is physiotherapy as well. And I don't prescription medications to treat cases, but I don't use them as my crutch. You know, I don't just say, here's your NSAID, bye. That's all I can do for arthritis. And they don't say, let me inject you with a monoclonal antibody to nerve growth factor and you don't need anything else. Because while those get rid of their pain, they do not slow the progression of the arthritis. So when you have a 17-year-old cat that comes in that you want to live another 5 years, you can't just give them pain medication because they're only going to last another year because the arthritis is going to progress. You need to
tackle it from all angles.
Exactly. So that could be anything from, you know, at-home exercises to, you know, intermittent laser therapy, ultrasound therapy, acupuncture, shockwave, all of those work well. Hydrotherapy yeah. to build muscle and reduce pain. And then, you know, in severe cases, as the arthritis or as the arthritis progresses, we will add in things like platelet-rich plasma injections or hyaluronic acid injections into the joint. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a new drug that it's a molecule that's a hydrogel of collagen, and it's a microparticle. You inject it into the joint. It's not approved in Australia yet, but it forms a cushion in the joint. And so it helps.
Interesting.
It slows the progression of arthritis because there's a lot less damage to the joint. Now, you're not specifically trying to treat pain. What you're trying to do is keep the cartilage present and healthy for as long as possible. And as long as you have cartilage there, you won't have severe pain. Once you have lost that cartilage in the joint, then you're grinding bone on bone. And that's when, you know, it gets really serious and the pain becomes maladaptive pain. And we start using medications and drugs to fight maladaptive pain. And, you know, that's when I bring out the monoclonal antibody, you know, to nerve growth factor and things like that, because at that point I'm really trying to fight that pain that I know, because I can't save the joint. The joint's gone.
Yeah.
Where's the car?
Yeah. So what I was going to ask is whether there's any supplements available that can actually help to rebuild lost cartilage that you know of.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There are a lot of supplements out there, as we know, and there's a lot of conflicting data. And one of the things you need to think about is, am I trying to slow the progression of the disease or am I trying to inhibit pain? And most of the supplements can do a good job of slowing the progression of the disease, but not inhibit pain. So I think that's important to think about. But if we can slow the progression of the disease, we can keep them active in other ways and intermittently fight any pain they have with nutraceutical or with NSAIDs, things like that. But
yeah,
nutraceuticals are really good at convincing the cells in the joint that everything is normal and that they should keep producing normal joint fluid and keep regenerating cartilage. And that's one of our goals. So we want to supplement them with things like, you know, glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate. That does help prolong the life of the joint. Is it going to make a difference in their pain? No. But also pentosan sulfate does that as well. And a lot of supplements that are geared toward normal joint components like hyaluronic acid and things like that. Then the next thing you want to do is so you've got all the components to make normal joint materials. Great. Then you want to also convince the body not to make enzymes that chew up the joint and to preserve that joint structure as it is. So that would be things that allow tolerance to collagen, because collagen is broken off in an arthritic joint. There's collagen debris present from the trauma. And that collagen debris then gains access to the bloodstream and can incite an inflammatory response. So by giving the glucosamine and by giving other components of collagen, like undenatured type 2 collagen, can be very helpful if we feed it to them orally, because it induces a state of tolerance. The body sees that normal component and doesn't react to it, nor does it react to the joint. And that's another way of hitting the mechanism of joint disease. So now we're providing optimal nutrition. The next thing we're going to do is inhibit inflammation when it occurs, and that is with omega-3 fatty acids and fish oils. Those inhibit periods of inflammation in the joint disease. So if we prevent inflammation from happening and we prevent a reaction to the degradation products from an arthritic joint, we can slow that progression down. And then finally, we need to provide the joint with the nutrition it needs to regenerate. And all of that can be done through supplements, actually.
Yeah, so what are the ingredients that the joint needs to actually regenerate? We've talked about the sort of protective mechanisms of glucosamine and chondroitin, but is there anything that actually can regenerate the cartilage?
Well, hyaluronic acid given orally, evidence that it can help regenerate cartilage too, because you can even inject it. It's more powerful if you inject it in the joint because it binds to the chondrocyte in the joint, and it only lasts in the joint for like 24 hours. It's not the point. The point is that it binds to the cell and says to the cell, make more of me. And you make more of your acid. So you convince the cells that everything is normal, everything's great. So you have, polysulfated glycosaminoglycans are important as well. And you can give things like elk velvet antler. Why does elk velvet antler help? It helps because it has mediators of recovery and regeneration. So it has growth hormones in it, which is great to stimulate recovery of that joint instead of death. So a productive process. And then it also inhibits inflammation because you want to grow your antlers. So it has proteins in it that inhibit inflammation just like omega-3s do in a similar manner. So again, another good way of presenting that. And I think the more ways we can inhibit the progression of osteoarthritis, the better off we will be. And it's all about preserving what we have.
Yeah. No, that's wonderful. Gosh, it sounds like there's actually so many choices out there. You've mentioned NSAIDs a couple of times, and I know that these are pretty widely used as a sort of first-line pain relief for arthritic patients in sort of general practice. When do you reach for them? How do you use them? And do you, I've heard sort of different vets use them at the start while the patient is then starting on everything else, like the supplements and the physio and everything, to then wean off the NSAIDs, or are you using them just on an as-needed basis? Or is it really just when they're very advanced and it's, nearing end of life and you just want to keep them comfortable? I'd love to hear your approach.
Yeah, so NSAIDs are very good at inhibiting pain, but they don't slow the progression of the disease. So what we want to do is in an inflammatory state, so they come in and they just, torn a ligament in their ankle, we give them NSAIDs for a period of, 5 days to inhibit that inflammation. We then stop giving it because now we want them to heal. And NSAIDs inhibit bone healing, they inhibit tendon and ligament healing. So we don't want to inhibit that. We want them to heal. So we want to get through that inflammation with the NSAIDs and then stop. So very short-term usage. Now, once an injury has healed, they can have periods of discomfort because never 100% normal. So if they have a highly active day and they're sore the next day, then they can give the NSAID just once. And it's very effective that way.
Yeah.
And so that's most dogs who are middle-aged and cats who are middle-aged. So if they need it, they get one dose. Then they would need intermittent use. So I do supply the client with a short amount of NSAID that they can use, but I'm really specific about, use this for 2 or 3 days. If they are still lame or exhibiting signs of discomfort or dysfunction, then I'll have them come in and visit me and we'll look at doing laser therapy or something like that.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So you're really using it very cautiously and very sparingly by the sounds of it.
Yeah. And then when they become geriatric and they have end-stage arthritis, I will give it more regularly, but I drop down to the lowest effective dose. So we'll start it at a therapeutic dose for a week or two, up to 2 weeks. And then we'll start dropping either the frequency or the amount. We'll decrease that slowly every 2 to 3 days. And in most cats, I'll get down to once or twice a week giving an NSAID.
Oh, okay. And, yep.
In most dogs, it's usually, again, probably 3 times a week, every other day that they get it. And that's much safer. So if you give an NSAID to a dog for 30 days at the prescribed dose, and this was looked at in for meloxicam, Prevacox, so
Piroxicam,
and carprofen, they found that at their therapeutic doses for 30 days, 84% of the dogs had GI ulceration.
Oh, wow.
They scoped them.
30 days, gosh.
Yeah, 84%. So if you give NSAID every day, you are causing disease. You're harming them.
That's scary. Wow. Okay. No, that's really important to emphasize, I think, as a big caveat to using NSAIDs, you know, and daily. Then,
yeah, with the monoclonal antibody to nerve growth factor, what I do recommend is that, one, you cannot use it long-term with NSAIDs. So you cannot give NSAIDs for more than 2 weeks if you're giving the monoclonal antibody injections once a month. You cannot do that. They will have rapid progression of their osteoarthritis.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And that's why it's not on the human market, because of that risk.
Yeah. Okay.
So when we don't tend to give the monoclonal antibody unless they have severe crippling disease or they're older. So again, more end stage arthritis, multiple joints, things like that. And it doesn't slow the progression of arthritis. It just inhibits pain, which is great because then we can build muscle. But you have to do everything else, environment, exercise, diet, in order to see an improvement overall in your animal.
Yep. No, that's very clear. Thank you. And I think that is a really nice segue into the sort of final thing that we wanted to discuss today, which is that end of life consideration. So you've talked a little bit about the end stage osteoarthritis patients. So how do you determine that they're end stage? Is it via radiographs, or is it just the sort of whole clinical picture and you know, behavior at home and history from the pet parent? And then when are you having these sort of discussions with your clients about, you know, considering end of life, and how is that final decision made, you know, with your advice on board, obviously?
Yeah, so for me, it's different for every individual animal, and about what, you know, my goal for all of my geriatric patients is that they are happy and they do what they love to do. So even if they're not running around. So for me, I have a discussion about what the owner's goals are, what the dog or cat really likes to do, what makes them happy and have a supportive home and family. And then we talk about goals and what we'll need to reach those goals. I do a thorough physical exam, and sometimes that's all I need. Sometimes I also take x-rays to determine, you know, the severity of whatever's going on. Again, I do an ortho and a neuro exam. I look at their mentation. We talk about their mentation. I have an older patient in right now. His name is Archie, and he just started therapy. And, you know, we talked about, does he have cognitive change? And there are actual assessments and questionnaires that you, as a general practitioner, can have the owners fill out online or ahead of time or in your hospital that assess their cognitive function, and you can get an idea of where they're at. And then there are also instruments, questionnaires that, like the Liverpool assessment score or the canine brief pain inventory, and those look at comfort, and you can give those periodically to the owners, and then you can assess more accurately where they're at and what you need to do.
Yeah. And that sort of quantitative data can sometimes help to make a decision too, when you have a comparison over, you know, 2 years and you can see the number going up.
Exactly. And so I had another patient named Jessica who she lived to be almost 18, and while we had her arthritis and her heart disease well controlled, in the end it became her cognitive dysfunction that was the limiting factor for the quality of her life. But we can decide what we want to do. And for some people, I always say to them, if they're not able to do their favorite thing in the world, and whether that be eating, most of my labs, it's eating, right? or is it going for a walk? You know,
just
walk. Is it chasing a toy? You know, is it into your lap and purring? If that has ended and that is not something that can happen, then that's when we need to respect their life and their happiness and think about where we're going to get at the end. Now, I always say, look, we can try these different therapies and modalities, and then I give them a specific time frame of, if we don't see significant improvement within that time frame, then we have to reassess and consider, you know, what's best for them.
Yeah.
And then that gives the owners time to monitor what they're doing, understand what's most important for their animal and for themselves. I had a lab who started coming to see me when he was 15. And I thought, you know, it's going to be less than 6 months, but he lived to be 17. He came in and got therapy once a week, and they asked for me to euthanize him in physiotherapy because he loved it so much. It was like his favorite thing to do. He would get so excited. And so when he stopped being able to eat, they were like, it's time. And he had a therapy session, and then we all said goodbye together. And he ended up with five different cancers.
Wow. Yeah. 17 for a lab is quite impressive.
Right. And you're like, wow. But I can sit there and say, wow, I don't think I would go that far for my own animal. But you know what? I always tell owners, I know whatever you decide is what is right, because you know them.
You know them best.
They know you. Yeah. And they trust you to make the right decision. So don't just go with your gut. You know, as the owner, is when most important to them. And if they're not getting that joy, then that's okay.
Yeah.
To let them go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, 100% agree. And I used to say something very similar when I was in practice, that, you know, you're the one who knows your animal best. You've been with them most of the time for their whole life or most of their life. And sometimes, I mean, even my experience with my own pets, and I've had a few horses over the years, sometimes you just go out one day and the light's gone out and you just know. You just know that they're okay and they're ready to say goodbye to the earthly life, and you just know. And I think that in a way it takes the pressure off people having to make this really hard decision when you just tell them, well, you just trust your instinct and your intuition and stay connected to your pet, and you will both know when the right time is. It's a very sad discussion to have this discussion, but I think it's important to all our listeners.
Yeah. And to know that we don't want to do anything that you and your pet don't want to do. I had one dog who, she was so surgically attached to me. She loved me so, so much. I couldn't board her anywhere because she would get diarrhea. She was so upset when I'd go out of town. And then she would give herself a urinary tract infection. It was horrible. And she did develop a brain tumor. And, you know, it was either she'd go to a hospital and stay there and have not me there and get radiation therapy every day for a month, or she spends the last 3 months of her life with me. And I knew that even 2 days away from me was not an option for her. It wasn't. She just wanted to be with me. So that's what we did. We were together every second until it was time. And
that's my
decision, because I was honoring her.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. Thank you for sharing that personal story, Wendy. I know it's always difficult to talk about past pets in our lives. And it can bring up a lot of emotions. And I know, you know, I know lots of people who have recently lost pets, and it leaves a big hole in your life, you know, emotionally and physically. And it's, you know, it's an important discussion to have. And thank you for having it with us on the podcast, Wendy. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
So I know we're getting close to time, and I think that's sort of a nice place to end. Is there anything else that we left out from our discussion today on sort of end of life care, or, you know, caring for geriatric pets, and with a particular focus on osteoarthritis, that you wanted to share with the listeners?
I would say, you know, a lot of people just want to ignore the fact that their dog or cat has become middle-aged, but I don't think it should be something that we don't want to think about. We need to embrace this. This is your friend and one of the best times of their life, because they know you, you know them. So let's enjoy it. But, you know, let's provide them with, there's been so many advances in geriatric care now that we can do all kinds of things to have that relationship go on for as long as possible. And have every moment of that life be wonderful and not about suffering, right? And so that's what I think we need to switch gears to say that as we age and as our animals age, we can embrace that as just a different kind of way of to live and to visit your and talk about that, because they are invaluable at helping you make that the best part of your animal's life.
Yeah, I love that. It's just sort of changing the mindset and the perspective around middle age. And I think probably a lot of us can apply that to our own lives as well, rather than the doom of gloom of sort of hitting 40 or 50. it's just a new chapter. Thank you so much, Wendy. I always love talking to you. You know, your passion for your work, I probably say it's more of a vocation for you than a job by the sounds of it, is just so palpable when I have conversations with you about any topic. But I really value all of your insights and your opinions and your, you know, your individual cases that you've shared with us today. I know that that can be really relatable for listeners, particularly for practitioners who have cases, you know, similar, or, you know, maybe have some really old dogs and cats coming in and feel that perhaps they don't have the confidence to, you know, suggest to the pet parent, well, you know, we could get another few years here if we do all of this. I think it's great to put all of that out there. So thank you so much. And I always look forward to having another discussion with you in the future.
Thank you so much. I had a really good time.
Thanks for listening to this month's episode of the Pure Animal Podcast. I'm Dr. Sarah Howard. Make sure you tune in next month, where I'll be talking to Dr. Matthew Muir about another fascinating topic in the world of integrative veterinary medicine. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for individualised veterinary advice, and listeners should ensure to seek advice from their pet's own veterinary professional.